Now, in a career that has spanned four decades, Luciano Pavarotti was arguably the most famous opera singer ever. And next week, a documentary on his life and times will hit cinemas. He's known affectionately as King of the High Seas, Maestro of the Masses. Both labels speak to his unique talent and personality, all of which we will explore now with the soprano, Claudia Boyle. I know you didn't meet him, but you liked him.
Oh, I loved him. Yeah, yeah. I have to say, if you're an opera singer, Pavarotti is the go-to. I mean, I was the biggest fan. You know, when I was younger, actually, it's kind of ironic because I used to make fun of opera singers when I was younger. And I think
aren't you a little brat?
I was, yeah. I got the hairbrush out and was making fun of opera singers. But so it's kind of ironic that I'm now an opera singer. But what the great thing was is that, you know, at the age of, I think I was seven, when he did the 1990 performance at the World Cup in Rome, that I knew who he was. And that was the wonderful thing about Pavarotti. Everyone knew who he was. He brought opera to people, to the masses.
Yeah.
You know, that a seven-year-old in Knockline knew who Pavarotti was and listened to Ness and Dorma. So that was the beauty of Pavarotti.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing about it is some of the purists will say, you know, that this isn't what should be done with opera at all, but we'll get there, as they say.
Yes.
Now, tell me about his early life. He taught. He mightn't have got to where he was because he didn't start out as a singer.
No, he didn't actually. Like, Pavarotti's first love was football, actually, when he was younger. He came from very humble beginnings. He grew up in the town of Modena. His father was a baker and an amateur tenor. So I think that was very important that his father did sing. I mean, that initially gave him the love of music.
Yeah.
Mother was, she worked in a cigar factory. So they were very, very poor. They shared a two-room apartment in Modena. So very humble beginnings. He joined a choir at the age of nine with his father, which was lovely. You know, again, keeping music in the family. And I think that really fostered the love of music in Pavarotti. Then at the age of 19, he decided he would study properly. So this was the time in his life when he took 6 years and studied really, really seriously with teachers. His first teacher, Arrigo Pola, was a tenor in Modena, so he studied with him for 2 years. And then after that, he studied with another teacher. It was Ettore Campo Galliani.
Now these are not household names. What was the significance of these?
Well, just that he was a very good teacher. His other student was Mirella Freini, who would again become a really huge star, and they would actually eventually share the stage on La Scala together. Now, they were childhood friends from Modena. So I suppose the significance is he was an excellent teacher, and that really fostered and nurtured the talent of Pavarotti.
Right, yeah. And then where to from there?
Well, where to from there? So after this, I mean, he spent 6 years studying, and he did a lot of recitals, a lot of free work, concert work, and, you know, with mixed success. Actually, during that time, he had vocal problems. He, you know, got a nodule
on
his vocal cords.
Yeah,
I mean, he spoke about that in his autobiography. He got nodules. And he really attributed that to the pressure and stress of wanting it so much, you know, really trying so hard and it not happening, you know, soon enough. So actually, he decided to give it up. He said, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. And as soon as he gave it up, the nodule went. And as soon as he gave it up, he could sing the way he wanted to. So it was really, I suppose, the pressure he was putting on himself, you know, to get there.
Is that a physical pressure or an emotional pressure?
It's both. You know, it's initially...
How does it work?
I suppose the vocal cords are so reactive. You know, if you're angry, if you're sad, it comes out in your voice. So like the pressure of wanting something so much, maybe over practicing, stress comes out in your voice as well. So, you know, they're very... I mean, at the end of the day, you're so human that really, you know, the vocal cords are just too little parts of flesh that rub off against each other and they create sound. And they're so susceptible to emotion,
right,
you know.
Yeah.
So as soon as he decided to give it up, then, you know, it all came together. And he did a competition. And the first prize of that competition, which he won, obviously, was to perform the role of Rudolfo in La Bohème in Reggio Emilia. And that's just actually, it's very near Modena as well. So that was his first professional debut. So that really kicked everything off. And it was at that competition that he met an agent who wanted to represent him. And then, yes, then he got his first role in Covent Garden. Now, that was actually by accident because Covent Garden were producing La Bohème at the time.
Yeah.
And they had the very famous tenor partner, Giuseppe Di Stefano. Now, he was kind of known for cancelling a lot. So they wanted someone on standby who was very, very good, but didn't mind not getting performing. The chance to perform.
Yeah, so, I would have thought that Pavarotti would be so insulted by that.
Yeah, well, you see, it came at a very good stage of his career.
Yeah.
He wasn't known. He was only starting out. So he had all this talent, but again, he wasn't known.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was a huge Di Stefano fan. So this was, you know, an amazing thing for him to be around him. And then as luck would have it, Di Stefano cancelled and Pavarotti got to perform his Covent Garden
amazing,
debut.
It
is amazing. And, you know, these things happen. People get sick and you get opportunities. You know, I mean, I myself got an opportunity. Somebody got sick in Salzburg and I got to sing most of a performance there. So, you know, great things can happen in your career and you need a bit of luck as well.
Yeah. You do. I guess you need a bit of luck wherever you go.
You do.
Now, tell me about him and Joan Sutherland.
Yeah, I mean, at that time, so he was getting well known. I mean, it didn't just happen overnight for Pavarotti, which in a way I kind of like because it, you know, looking back on his career, huge career, that sometimes if people just get famous overnight, it can, you know, go away very quickly as well.
Yeah.
So it was a nice steady rise. He was getting known and he was really learning his craft. So at that time, Joan Sutherland was doing a tour of Australia. And it's funny because she wanted a tenor who was as tall as her or taller. She was sick of doing operas with these short tenors. And she said, I'm sick of, you know, facing my romantic lead and I'm coming up to my navel, she was quoted as saying, you know. And she was very tall. She was quite a dominant figure and she was amazing. She was just a stunning singer. Again, I'm another big fan there.
Yeah.
But she wanted a tall tenor. So they decided to ask Pavarotti. And then that was a match made in heaven. She thought he was fabulous. And he really attributes his technique to Joan Sutherland. He said her breathing was just second to none. That when he was on stage with her and he had his arms around her, he could feel her diaphragm working so hard that every time, just about, you know, just when she was going to start singing, her diaphragm was engaged. And really, he just said it was all down to her breathing technique, that she was just fabulous. So this technique really sustained him throughout a very, very long career, you know, longer than most, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Because of the word diva, you know.
Yes. Diva and Devo were
diva,
used to
Devo,
them.
Diva, yeah.
Yeah.
There is this image, rightly or wrongly, that, you know, people looking over the shoulder don't want her to get the big bus and she doesn't want him to get the big... Does that really happen in real life?
Oh, it does. I mean, the thing is, he spoke about that as well. I mean, when he was doing the tour of Australia, he was really looking at fame and what it was. And I suppose part of him wanted that as well. He said in the opera houses, they loved him. But outside the opera houses, it was all about her, you know, because she was just such a name at the time. And so, you know, I suppose he did want that. I mean, he did court fame. He courted the media.
Oh, yeah.
And that was, you know, something that maybe some people did frown upon, as you say, the purists, you know, looked on that as maybe, you know, bringing opera down.
Opera light.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But what's wrong with it? It brought opera to the masses and it was a wonderful thing.
Well, listen, we can't go on without hearing a thing or two. And this is going to be in the context that he was famous for the high seas,
High seas.
Tell us the background to this.
Okay, well, Pavarotti is a lyric tenor, but he possesses this wonderful range. And up until now, this specific aria, it's a really fiendish aria from La Fille du Régiment, and it has these nine high Cs. Now, generally, this up to now had been done by a lighter tenor, but all of a sudden, Pavarotti was singing this with this big, full-bodied lyric voice, and it was just so thrilling. He initially did it, he debuted the role in Covent Garden, again, to great success. But then his huge big break in the United States was when he sung this role at the Met. And when he sung it, the crowd absolutely went wild and he got 17 curtain calls.
There you go. And what's it called?
It's the aria is Ah, mes amis, quel jour de fête. Oh, my friends, what a day for celebrating. And here, Tonio, he has just joined the regiment because he loves the regiment's daughter and he has been told that he can have her hand. So he is just thrilling and excited at the prospect of this.
what can you say, really?
On a Saturday morning, yeah. It doesn't get better than that. No, really,
in the middle of summer, absolutely. Being able to do that high C is really important.
Yeah, it is, because, you know, I don't want to sound cheap or anything like that, but they're the money notes. They're the notes people want to hear, you know. And again, also they're in the scores. So if you want to sing a certain role and you don't have that note, it stops you from singing it. So this was the repertoire that he wanted to sing. So it was very, very important for him. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And you say that if you are a good singer and you have the high C, you'll have a good career.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the high C is the cherry on top. It's the icing sugar. The high C is just,
All of those important. Good things. Yes. Now, when he started out, he was devoted to serious opera. And what were his favourite roles?
Well, he had three favourite roles. So there was Nemorino from L'Elisir d'Amore. There was also Gustavo from Un ballo in Mascara. And then there was also Rodolfo in La Bohème. So these were his three favourite roles. He loved singing them. In fact, the aria Una Furtiva Lagrima from L'Elisir d'Amore, he always used that as his test aria. So he said if he could sing that aria, he knew his voice was going to be okay for the night.
Okay, well, that wasn't the sequence in which we had intended doing them. But since you mention it, we will play exactly that.
Oh, great.
And that told him that his voice was in good shape.
Yeah, it did. I mean, that specific aria is centred around a kind of break point in a tenor's voice. So we call it the passaggio. So it's where the chest voice meets the head voice and they have to kind of mix it. So it's really focuses on their technique. And if they've got a great technique, they can sing that aria with ease. So we always felt that was a great aria to test his voice. And again, there's nothing like an Italian singing, Italian music.
Oh, you're right.
Because
very annoying, isn't it?
Oh, God, we hate them. We really hate them. But they just know how to sing. They know how to produce sound. They know how to produce beautiful sound. And I suppose that's where, you know, the phrase bel canto comes from, beautiful singing. And that's, you know, Italians know opera. Opera came from Italy. So, again, there's just nothing better than an Italian singing Italian music. And it was this role as well. He loved it because nobody died. You know, Nemorino was your lovable country bumpkin, you know. And he was lovelorn, but then he gets the girl at the end. So,
yeah,
you know,
which is very unusual, isn't it?
Very unusual, happy ending. And his children also loved this role, so it was very special to him.
Right.
Yeah.
By the way, I presume people know he used to buy horses in Ireland at one stage.
He bought two horses in Ireland, he did.
Down in Gardaecare, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he loved Ireland, and you know, and he loved Bono as well. He plagued Bono to write a song for him as well.
Yeah, and that thing of partnering outside of your own tradition or your own speciality, he liked doing that.
Oh yeah, he loved it. I mean, I think he was very much a people person, and very charismatic, and certainly in the 1990s, after the World Cup, after that huge performance with the three tenors, I mean, that's when really it kicked off. I mean, that's when he was in stadiums and arenas. I mean, it had been building, but after that, I mean, that was the biggest selling classical album of all time, that performance.
Right.
So it was after this that he did pair up with people. You know, he sung the Ave Maria with our very own late Dolores O'Riordan. And then, yes, he did. He plagued Bono to write this song for him. That he could sing in as well. And I suppose that was another way of getting, you know, opera, classical music out there.
Yeah.
You know, and again, some people didn't like it. I didn't see a problem with it. I don't see a problem with it,
right,
you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Tell us about the origins of the three tenors, because bits of it are very funny. I know you're not supposed to say funny, but
no,
the three
great.
Of them.
Yeah, the three.
I mean, we were talking about Devo, Devi, whatever they
oh,
are.
Oh, yes.
I mean, there were three egos there. Now, they
huge.
Made beautiful sound.
Yes.
But tell us all that, how all that came about.
Well, I mean, there was an Italian producer, Mario Draghi, and it was his initial vision to have these three huge stars on the stage together.
The other two being?
The other two being José Carreras and Plácido Domingo. Mm. So, yeah, to get these stars all together, do a huge concert and donate part of the proceeds to José Carreras had been very sick.
That's
he had
right.
suffered from leukemia, and to donate the proceeds to that. So they did that on the eve of the World Cup final in Rome. And, you know, I just want to set the scene here. It was in the baths of Caracalla and, you know, the World Cup fever was in the air. The sun had just set in Rome and there was an unbelievable atmosphere. There was excitement. And on top of that, beautiful music. And on top of that, by three amazing stars, you know, of
yeah.
their time and all on the stage together. And there was a great atmosphere because, you know, it wasn't stuffy. It was very relaxed. It was playful. You know, a memorable point of the night was singing O Sole Mio, and Domingo and Carrera started really making fun of Pavarotti the way he was singing it. And there was this kind of one-upmanship, a playful one-upmanship going on. And of course, they finished the performance with the very famous and powerful Nessun Dorma.
Okay, here we go. What a truly brilliant idea to have that as the theme song.
Oh, yes.
For the World Cup. Now, it wasn't always all smooth, and particularly towards the end. He ended up banned from Chicago, isn't that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
And people started criticising his voice and criticising his ego and criticising his lifestyle and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, it was it's a tough profession, Marion. I mean, you know, you're giving yourself all the time. You're making huge sacrifices. You're away from home. You're lonely. You know, so there is this wonderful side to it where you're, you know, adored by the public. But then there's a lonely side to it. So, I mean, I would have given huge allowances for that. You know, and opera singers, we're a little bit neurotic because if we get a common cold, it stops us from singing.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a very thin line. So I do give a lot... I would give him a lot of allowances for the behaviour and for the, you know, he was maybe a slight hypochondriac because if anything, I mean, you weren't allowed to go near him sometimes because of germs. He was afraid of germs all the time. And again, if you have that big pressure, if you're playing to stadiums, arenas, and the pressure to always be good and perfect is always on you. So I would allow for that. Yeah, he did. He gained a reputation, actually, king of the cancellations. Because
that's the last thing you'd want, isn't it?
Yes, Lyrikov of Chicago actually publicly banned him because he just cancelled so many times, and he actually cancelled, you know, a huge amount of performances there. He failed to show up for 26 of 41 engagements.
That's, yeah.
So that was an awful lot. And, you know, then there was... a broadcast where he lip-synced from Modena. Now, he brings that up as well in his autobiography. He said he basically was just taking on too much. Everybody wanted a piece of him. And I suppose he found it very hard to say no.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. It is hard to say no, you know.
Yeah.
You want to do everything. You want to perform. He loved performing. So I think that was certainly something that got the better of him. Along with sickness, I think his you know, his weight certainly didn't help. Illness
no.
either.
No.
So all of those factors. But then when people did start criticising him, you know, his last performance was in the Met, and I think at the age of 68.
It's not bad.
Oh my God, it's not bad at all. And you have to remember, you're not going to get a 38-year-old Pavarotti. You are getting an older man, an older voice.
Yeah.
And one thing in the documentary, which I personally loved actually, was that Bono really defended him in that. And he said, you know, you are the sum of all your past. You're the, you know, you hear it in every crack.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, don't judge too harshly, you know, accept it for what it is. And it's, you know, it's Pavarotti at 68 getting up there and singing. You know, it's amazing.
There you go. And I presume it's addictive for yes. for all of you. And just to say that Ron Howard's Pavarotti, it'll be in cinemas from Monday. Is there much music in it?
Oh, Marion, this is wonderful. I mean, I cried so many times in this documentary.
Lovely.
In fact, I wouldn't personally call it a documentary. It's more of a tribute and homage.
Right.
And if you loved Pavarotti, you will love this. I cried so many times. He sings Pagliacci. And then at the end, he sings the final Nessun Dorma. And, you know, I defy you not to be moved.
Not a dry eye in yeah. the house. There you go. Listen, thank you very, very much indeed. And every continued success with your own career.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.